This week on the show, Egypt and the Arab world feel the force of the internet. Canada starts to make it more expensive, and Pepsi uses some of its dollars for social good driven by social media. Right here on This Week in Media, number 221. Hey everyone, welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex, and we have a very formidable group of people here to talk about formidable news. Coming in from Thousand Oaks, California, Larry Jordan. Hey, Larry.
Hello, Mr. Alex.
And from Los Angeles, we've got Tim Street. Hey, Tim.
I'm so glad to be back. I've missed This Week in Media all year long so far.
We missed you too. You've been traveling to bandwidth.
Deprived, yeah.
Yeah, deficient hotels.
Time for a group hug.
And then also, not to leave him out from the group hug, Lon Sideman is coming in from Connecticut.
You got to dig me out of all this snow first, then I'll be happy to hug you all.
It's
crazy.
That's
what they invented hot coffee and fireplaces for.
Yes, I got a nice fake fireplace, although I have to dig out my propane tank to keep it going.
Right. So, right. How far is Killington from you?
Killington is about maybe 2 or 3 hours from me.
But you can't get there.
I could, maybe not today.
Okay. I bet you the skiing will be great in Killington, at least until it rains.
Right. Then it'll be all icy. But yeah, it's been a pretty good year for the ski people, definitely.
Yeah. And it was a couple of bad years, so I think that's finally they're getting their due. So,
oh, yeah.
So anyway, sounds good. We've got a lot of breaking news. Here's the big news this week is Egypt. Shutting down the internet. I mean, you hear about people talking about the government's wanting to shut down the internet. You just don't think it's actually possible. But it turns out that it was for Egypt. So around 10:30 GMT on Thursday, this is according to Yahoo News, they just shut down the country. So that, 23 million Egyptians were cut off from internet access. And so, and of course, they were trying to control the pumping excitement and frustration that has been taking over Egypt right now, that has been kind of coming over from Tunisia. Now, the interesting thing here is that it didn't stop it, didn't slow it down that much. We don't know how much it slowed it down, but it was interesting that it was possible at all. Larry, what do you think that this says about what governments can do as it relates to social media and the internet?
Well, I think it's just simply characteristic of what governments have been trying to do since the beginning of time. I mean, look at the impact that the telephone and cell phone had back in the 60s when they started to finally take off. Or you look back at the telegraph or just the fact that what governments want to do when things get bad is they want to clamp down on the ability of citizens to communicate whatever technology they're using. So I don't see anything new in terms of what governments that are autocratic are trying to do. The newness is simply in that they're clamping down on something that didn't exist 15 years ago, which is social media and the internet.
Right. Now, and one of the things about this is the question I have for you, Lon, is that can a government maintain control over an internet-enabled society? I mean, can it have that positive control when people have all these ways of communicating?
I think there's some immediate things that they may have control over, which is what happened here in Egypt. But what's fascinated me was just how quickly people innovated around the censorship, right? The most intriguing thing for me, and it's kind of apropos because I actually did a little winter project thing stuck in the house as long as I've been, actually set up an old BBS system, which I don't know if you ever were into BBSing, Alex, back in the day. But
it was before he was born.
Yeah, well, I was actually connected with my 9600 baud modem. It was very fast.
It was real zippy. That was like having the Mercedes on the info highway. And what's happened though is that people have taken there was a network called, and it still exists actually, and I just rejoined it, called FidoNet. And what FidoNet did was connected about at its height about 20,000 bulletin board systems worldwide, completely hobbyist driven. There was no, ICANN or any kind of authority with it. One would just dial up the next and it would just work its way around the world every night. These were just message boards and that kind of thing. And what people have done now is they've taken that technology and have applied it locally to, and this is the actual FidoNet technology, or applied it locally to what's going on in Egypt. And a few tweets that I read coming out of there said that they were actually echoing electronic messages from one computer to the other in Cairo via Wi-Fi until it landed on a machine that would dial out internationally and then bridge it or gate it over to the internet. Some highly geeky stuff. And unfortunately, a bunch of those system operators were shut down this morning, it seems like, and arrested, which is unfortunate. But the fact is, if you have a phone line that works, you can get some information out. If you have Wi-Fi that you can at least get going on a computer somewhere, I think it's almost impossible to shut it down. You can certainly slow down the process of communicating, but I don't think any government can control this network anymore, at least to the standpoint of keeping it totally silent. And this morning, of course, Google and Twitter actually teamed up on a new venture that I guess Google just acquired, which allows people to dial an international phone number and have that voice recording then be broadcast out on Twitter. And that address is speak the number 2 tweet on Twitter to listen to those calls.
Alex?
Yeah.
I was listening to NPR last night. They were talking about this, and something that I did not know is that while we think of the internet as being sort of everywhere, in point of fact, there are points of connection for the main ISPs to connect to the web. And for example, in the United States, most of the international traffic that goes to Asia in the U.S. goes through a single building in Los Angeles. It's a very famous building. It's called One Wilshire. And all of the 90% of the internet traffic that goes to Asia goes to that one single point of that's not a single cable, but it's a single physical location. So although we think of the internet as being everywhere, in point of fact, in many cases, it isn't. And Egypt, not being a very big country, only has 5 ISPs with access to the outside world. So it's fairly easy to shut down if all you have are 5 connections to work with.
Well, and you have a lot of the other thing that you have is there is, you know, when you look at Africa as well as when you look at East Africa, which is having a lot of internet coming in, but there's still only a limited number of pipes that are coming in, and it gets real slow, you know, after you get out of that. Now, one of the other things that was going on, and this is a question coming to you, Tim, is that, you know, a lot of people, you know, Al Jazeera, for instance, Al Jazeera English can't get any kind of distribution in the United States. No cable network will touch them. There's a lot of people like me who stream them a lot. I watch Al Jazeera a lot because it's the best international news in existence. If you want to know what's going on in Africa or the Middle East or Asia, and you're in the United States, Al Jazeera English is cleanly the best way to get really good information from people that are actually on the ground. But they can't get distribution here. But what's interesting is that what we thought was defender of, you know, whatever the powers that be in the Arab world actually became instrumental in continuing to move this Egyptian process down the path, because they're broadcasting what's happening. And it turns out, because the infrastructure, the TV infrastructure, was so bad in Egypt, Egyptians, like many in Africa and the Middle East, have satellite dishes. So while they shut down the TV and they shut down the internet, didn't shut down anything that has to do with the satellite. They didn't shoot the satellites down. And Al Jazeera just kept on pumping out video of what's actually happening, which, of course, creates that feedback loop of people continuing to do it. Tim, do you think that this is going to have cable operators here in the United States rethink their stance on distributing Al Jazeera? And do you think that Al Jazeera might have a positive effect when it comes to democratizing the Middle East?
You know, it just boils down to agents. You know, if somebody at ICM can figure out a way for Al Jazeera to make some money here, it's going to happen. You know, you have all these cable channels now that are very targeted and have specific audiences. It just boils down to sheer numbers as to whether or not enough people are going to watch it. And if Comcast can get a piece of it as well. I mean, they pretty much own every cable network out there or have a piece of it. To me, the whole thing seems to boil down to, we're at this point now where you have to deliver to your audience what they want, or you have to give them something that pleases them. And that's the same in running a government. You know, with social media now, people can start complaining. They can create problems for you, whether you're a business or whether you're a government. I think we're going to see the same thing happen with companies that aren't treating their customers right. And it's people are going to have to be on their best behavior because of social media.
Well, it does seem interesting that, you know, this is starting. This is like it's just like this crazy wildfire that's happening right now in some of these governments across the, you know, you saw it in Tunisia, and it seems like people are feeding off of that media news, you know, and you see some of the countries trying to clamp down. You see other ones today, you know, Jordan is shaking up the king of Jordan is shaking up the entire government, trying to stay ahead of this and taking proactive measures. To stay ahead of this, you know, in some ways I feel like what Jordan's doing is like one of the things, like if you see a forest fire coming, one of the things that we were told when I was in East Africa is actually a lot of guys there will actually light a fire, you know, right under them, because it'll burn towards the brush fire and clear all the area out around you. So that's actually the fighting fire with fire, is actually to burn right where you can control it and then let it stop, you know, and not get eaten up by the entire brush fire. And it looks like Jordan is trying to get ahead of that. Now, given that we're talking about Jordan, I think we need to talk ask Larry Jordan what he thinks of what's happening as far as this expansion and how the media
I think what's happening, you know, one of the old axioms we live with is the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And a lot of people are equating all the turmoil in Tunisia and Egypt and the succession inside Sudan is all equated with a push to democracy. And I think that what we're seeing is that there is a revolt against autocratic rule, but not necessarily a rush to democracy.
But here's the question, is it even possible to do this without the media?
Oh, yeah. Tell me, has ever a revolution occurred prior to the advent of social media? And the answer is, of course, yes, because people communicate. Oh, Alex, you'll love this. You ready? You sitting down?
I'm sitting down.
Okay. I did some homework specially for you. I don't do this for a living, but I did some homework just for you. And I went back to the American Revolutionary War. Now, even Tim will admit that the Revolutionary War somewhat predates social media. Okay? And I said, how is it possible that we could have a successful revolutionary war without social media? It flies in the face of logic. So I said, how did they do it? And they did it with two things. Number one, they used letters, handwritten letters with secret code that would be carried from one person to another at great personal risk. But the secret code would say, I'm going to get groceries, but it actually means invade this fort at 10 o'clock on Tuesday. And the other thing they used was drummers. If you remember the drummer, they would have secret drum codes. And because the drum could be heard for long distances, they could instantly communicate to people by the way the drummer was beating a rhythm with his drum. Communication is essential to any kind of revolutionary movement, and you take advantage of the technology at hand. And what's happened is the social media has made the technology much more responsive. But it doesn't mean that revolutions or upheavals can't occur without it, but it just makes it faster to respond. And because it's the most visible, it's the first thing governments think of when they decide to clamp down on stuff.
Right. Now, with Egypt clamping down, one of the things that we've heard the president actually here in the United States talk about and people and representatives is the call for some kind of off switch. You know, for the United States, you know, the idea is that we could get control of the internet and turn, stop everything if there was a national emergency. Lon, do you think that this, what happened in Egypt is a bit of a lethal blow to any call that anyone's going to have about creating some kind of centralized off switch? Will this scare people too much about what the government might do this for?
I think it will. I mean, I think it, you know, certainly they did try to explain that the prior effort was only for certain segments that might be under a cyber attack or some kind of national emergency. I'm pretty certain that we're going to see some kind of legislation to at least address the issue of some kind of cyber attack. But I think the issue is going to be a lot more public and certainly discussed a lot more within both the tech media, but also the mainstream media, to try to figure out the best way to do this in such a way that this would not give someone the ability to turn off people's ability to speak. And I think that ultimately is the balance that they're going to have to strike between, as always, between security and the public's ability to be free. And America as the United States is really an example to the world of what a free press and a free flow of communication should be very mindful of what we do when those discussions begin, certainly.
Lon?
Yes.
Just a question. Do you see a parallel between the discussion for an off switch and the discussion occurred 20 years ago when the government put in backdoor wiretapping to most cell phones?
Yeah, what's interesting is that there already is an off switch that was put in back, I don't know, maybe in the 30s or 40s, over the telephone network, that the government has the ability to actually disconnect wired services that are not delivering internet traffic at that point. And, you know, we're constantly dealing with this issue. And some could argue that those wiretapping laws on cell phones led to the capture of terrorists, which I'm sure it has. And at the same time, we want to make sure that we don't turn into something like Egypt, that if there are people who are expressing an opinion, and we see plenty of them expressed on the internet daily, we want to make sure that everyone has the ability to, you know, to be able to get that word out at the same time, keeping the nation safe. And that's really, I think, almost incumbent upon the supporters of any kind of kill switch legislation to be very specific as to what it requires and what it will do, and perhaps some authority that could oversee that, so it doesn't just get done by a single stroke of the pen.
Hey, if you ever go to CES, you feel like the government has shut down the internet. You can't get a phone call out or in or a text or email. It's horrible.
So maybe AT&T is in Cairo. That could be what the problem is.
Yeah. We don't know. I mean, it's just I have experienced that. You know, the crazy thing, though, is that you can actually get a lot of calls out if you just switch to Edge. You just switch your cell phone from 3G to Edge.
Hey, Ixnay, I'm the 2GA.
Yeah. So and you just slip right out. Right, well, under everybody's nose, and where they're not looking. So anyway, that I think we're going to have a lot more to talk about there. I think this is going to be something that we're going to continue. It looks like it's going to continue through Sudan, Jordan. You know, people are afraid that this might happen in Saudi Arabia. You know, and of course, this could have all kinds of effects on our energy markets and so on and so forth. So we'll talk about this again, most likely in the next couple weeks, because I think we're going to see a lot more progressing in this area. But it is a very interesting, development as far as how media continues to accelerate, you know, a lot of this, a lot of these pieces. Now, also in the story, now you can talk a lot in Canada, but it turns out not as much as you used to be able to. This is according to Ars Technica. Metered internet usage, also called usage-based billing, or UBB, is coming to Canada. Now, it has been approved that the ISPs, the big ISPs, specifically Bell Canada, can charge usage-based fees to the small ISPs that are capping in. So here's what happens is that a lot of these small ISPs, the one in this article for Ars Technica, specifically Tech Savvy, what happens, they have the right to tap into the last mile with the bells. We have the same kind of thing here in the United States, into the pole, but they have to pay a usage fee, and it hasn't been a but they haven't had to pay, you know, per data. And now what's essentially happening is in Canada they're allowed to do that, and now they're having to charge and cap subscribers who used to have unlimited deals or 200 gigabyte deals down to 25 gigabytes per month, which, you know, I think sounded astronomical only a year or two ago. But now it is, a lot of us go through that in a week, just watching Netflix. So Larry, do you think that this is going to affect Canada's media competitiveness?
Well, you know, I think there's a whole lot of different things this is going to affect. And the first thought that came to mind is, tell me any customer that enjoys paying more for the same service. I think there's going to be a huge pushback on this. On the other hand, what we're seeing is that the people, the ISPs, are not making money on the data that's going over their network. And so the problem, I think, is that they've got to build out this huge infrastructure, and there's no easy way to pay for it. So I could see both sides of this. One, we want more data, we want it faster, and we want it everywhere. And that costs a lot of money to put the towers and the transmission stuff in place, because it's really being driven by mobile. If it wasn't for mobile, this would be a non-issue. But with the exploding of mobile devices, which means you could have massive data transfers wandering around as you carry your cell phone around, the infrastructure's got to grow, and they got to pay for it, and they can't make money on the data being transmitted until this comes in. I think there's a lot of different impacts here. One, the thing that first came to my mind is online sales and online retail is going to be impacted by this. And media, and whether you're able to watch Netflix is one thing, but whether you're able to watch the news, that's something different. I think there's going to be a lot of impact, and there's points to be made on both sides.
Well, and one of the things is that while they were making money on selling you a value-added good, which is the cable. You know, you're paying your subscription for your cable, but more and more people, I think that they see the writing on the wall that more and more people are, you know, cutting that line. You know, as I look at my cable bill, I'm oftentimes thinking, you know, I'd rather have a faster, more internet speed and pay for it and just get rid of my TV. You know, okay. and that is a, you know, but they don't make it, they don't make nearly as much money on that process. And so I think that is a piece of it. Now, do you think, Lon, do you think that these small ISPs can survive if they start getting squeezed, you know, to pay a lot more and start having to limit their what they provide?
This kind of happened when broadband took over, right? That the infrastructure to provide broadband services was more than a lot of dial-up providers could handle. When I transitioned away from that BBS to the internet, my ISP had a time limit. So I could use 100 hours a month, and then they would charge me like, you know, 50 cents an hour or something like that after I hit the limit. But I do think competition will likely solve this problem in the end, that at some point some broadband provider, whether it's a, you know, some fancy high-end subspace wireless transmission or something like that, will emerge and say, look, we're not going to put limits on what you use. And that might ultimately lead to some competition that hopefully will get these limits a little bit more reasonable. One thing I am encouraged by is the fact that now with the Verizon iPhone arriving, there's been some reports that AT&T, for people who are out of contract, is extending the actual is extending the broadband limit so that people can get a little bit more available gigabytes per month if they agree to stay on with the service. There's actually some haggling going on, given that Verizon's limited plan is less limited than AT&T's. So
I have to say, I may or may not have seen an example of LTE.
Is it fast?
Oh my gosh.
Because my Verizon rep was on the phone with me this morning, and she was raving with statistics so crazy. I said it's not possible.
All I got to say is that I was looking at this video they were playing on this Android, and I said, so how fast does the system have to be able to play that? I was just worried about the video card and the playback speed of the flash memory that it was playing that video on the Android, and he looks at me and he goes, no, that's streaming. I mean, it was crystal clear at 960x540 or whatever it was. I mean, the clearest video I've ever seen on a phone, and it wasn't being played back internally. It was streaming off the and he said the camera was just as good. You know, like shooting the video was just as good, and it was stunning. You know, and so you know, so I mean, I couldn't, you know, I was I immediately looked at my live view box and I was like, I don't really know if I'm going to need that, you know, much longer. You know, it's quite a thing. So now, Tim, do you think that this will hurt Canadian media or help it?
You know, it's interesting to think about this in terms of, you know, you look at somebody like Bell or Rogers. Not only are they providing the internet, but they're also providing the programming. So I think it'll sort itself out. But we're seeing this kind of stuff here already with the iPhone and the iPad. I mean, you used to be able to get unlimited plan when they first started out. You got unlimited data. Then it was like 5 gig a month, and then it's 2 gig a month. And it's you know, they keep messing with the payment plan. It drives you crazy.
My idea now, as I've been thinking about this, is I think that Google, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and maybe a couple other companies that have that really are trying to build this out should just all build a company and invest like $50 billion and then just go after the top 20 markets and just take them away from AT&T and Verizon. Like 1 gigabit connection, you know, WiMAX through the whole thing. And I
thought Google was doing that. I really thought they were going to deploy a nationwide WiMAX. And I thought that's why they were pushing for net neutrality. And then when that thing happened with Verizon, it's like, okay, maybe not.
Well, I just felt like if these companies, these big companies, just, you don't have to, the thing is you don't have to make it nationwide. You only have to take out the top 10 markets or so. And the pain would be enough to force most of these other, most of the providers to change everything about what they do, because they would see very quickly that if Apple and Google and all these other guys, whatever this company is, came to their market, they'll just take it one after another. Because the idea is that we're not trying to make money on that bandwidth. We're trying to make money on the fact that people now can use their devices the way that they were designed. And with a different business model like that, you know, and I did think that that's where Google was going, but I think that a consortium of companies that all need this bandwidth to exist, you know, would make, and of course that'll never happen, but I can dream.
I don't think it can ever be quite that organized. I think chaos rules in the market. And sometimes when things happen, they happen not because they were planned, but because of unintended consequences. I think that's what's happening up in Canada.
I think the danger really is that I think Canada and the United States are great examples of countries that are so, it's like, it's the difference between, you know, driving through a Western city and an East Coast city, where, you know, in the East Coast, it's like Pittsburgh is like a bunch of cow paths that got paved, you know, there's, you know, and it was all built around a triangle. So the whole thing is just this mess of roads. And then you go to, you go to a city in the West and everything's in nice, you know, we figured this out, like we figured out how to make this work. And so all these new countries that didn't have any infrastructure, when they build them, you know, they're building them with some level of organization that will get this out quicker. And I guess my fear is that the United States is going to fall behind. You know, as far as being able to provide these services, because there's so much locked up by all these providers, and, you know, and the government can't compete with them, and they can't, you know, so it can't push that down. And the question really is, and here's a question for you, Larry, should we think about, or for all of you, should we start thinking about whether internet should be a utility?
Well, I think that thought's already going in. And how do you regulate the utility, and how do you tax the utility, and how do you guarantee the utility for different strata of society? I think that conversation's been ongoing for a while.
I mean, it just seems like it's almost time for us to stop thinking about this as a service and start thinking about it as, you know, it doesn't make any sense anymore the way it's working, and we're going to make it the next PG&E or the next whatever it is, and not start to rationalize that process.
I think the more you make it a utility, the harder it's going to be to enforce change, not enforce change, but the more it becomes a utility, the harder it is for it to change. Hmm. Because by definition, a utility is very fixed in focus. Think of the electric company, the gas company. They deliver electricity, they deliver gas, but they're not necessarily charged with coming up with new forms of electricity. Or, you know, the internet is still evolving so quickly that I think we need to come up with regulation which treats it as a utility but doesn't turn it into a utility.
Interesting. Now, jumping onto our next story. We have State of the Union was of course, on many, many websites live. There was a lot of people that were showing it, but it was very hard to find on the iPad or the iPhone. A lot of people who went up, this is according to CNET, you know, they were going up, and most of these, you know, most of this was all done in Flash. So HTML5 hasn't made it out yet. You know, big important events are still not making it to the iPad or the iPhone. I know some of our streaming stuff, we're still having trouble getting it to the iPhone and iPad, and I hear about it all the time. I'm working on it. So, this is still a challenge for people. Now, do you think, Tim? Do you think that this is going to continue to add pressure to Apple to adopt Flash for the platform?
You know, the problem isn't Flash for the platform. What's going on? I mean, I spent a lot of time talking with broadcasters and cable networks. There's a TV everywhere strategy that's being put in place, and the networks are trying to figure out how they're going to best address that from a business model. And so rather than just rush to the iPad and put their stuff there, they're sorting that out. I mean, when you look at a company like Fox, does, you know, somewhere around $3.5 billion a year in cable licensing fees. And for them to dilute that by making their content available on the iPad, because it would upset the MSOs that are paying them licensing fees, that's something they've got to wrestle with. And so that's what we're seeing. I mean, the technology is there. They could do it tomorrow, you know, through HTML5 adaptive bitrate streaming. And HLS is really the preferred method that, you know, if you look at Hulu, if you look at ABC, they're using that right now. And it's a great experience. I also hear that it's going to work on, I know it does work on the Android, but in the next version of Android OS, HLS will be part of that as well. But I wouldn't count out, you know, Flash from coming up with something else, or Adobe coming up with something else other than Flash to address this issue. People want to watch content on the iPad. They will get to as soon as the business models are sorted out.
Larry, do you see a winner eventually in this area, or are we just going to constantly be watching Flash and or HTML5?
How much black and white TV do you watch?
Not a lot.
Right, same thing. But if you look at it, it took a long time for color to take over from black and white. There was a lot of infrastructure issues. There were a lot of production issues. It just took a while. And we've got a huge shift here. And I disagree with Tim only a little bit. I love his analogy of the business model. I think he's dead on with that. But I think the process of reprogramming a website to take it away from Flash and move it to HTML5 is not a trivial undertaking and probably could not be done by tomorrow. I'd give it till Thursday morning at the latest. But it just, you don't want to go to that effort until you make sure you've got all the ducks in a row.
Right.
And I think what Apple is going to do, to get back to your original question, is Apple's not going to adapt Flash. That's just, that's history. It's not going to happen. What Apple's going to concentrate is making HTML5 more accessible.
It would take more than till Thursday. It would take 2 weeks, but I could have you I could have you serving HTML5 video on your website with multi mid rolls and geo targeted interactive overlays in 2 to 3 weeks.
You'd have to take 2 to 3 weeks to explain to me what you just said.
Lon, do you think is there going to be a shakeout here eventually?
Oh, there has to be. There has to be. I mean, with so many devices out there, the fact is that all of those millions of people who, like me, are glued to their iPad every night are going to go to the places where Tim can serve them video. And and that's great for Tim, and I think that's the way things work.
Do you think that one of the problems is that, I mean, and this was exactly part of what Larry was talking about, was that one of the real issues is it's just very hard to author. You know, or much harder to author, you know, HTML5 than it is for Flash. I mean, you have tons and tons of people who do Flash development, and so that is. It seems like that is a huge piece. And I've been surprised that Apple hasn't adapted some of their authoring tools to really take full advantage of the HTML5 platform or the iPad and iPhone platforms to make it much easier to develop content for it. Because I think that's part of the problem is that, I have to go through all this process rather than just posting it.
Yeah, that's exactly. I think that it needs to get easier, especially for people like me, because my budget is all in cameras and people. I have to rely on the open source tools that are available to get this stuff done. I'm a programmer, you know, loosely, but not enough to that I have the time to sit down and code things. So right, having something that's Final Cut Pro easy would be awesome, definitely.
As someone, we do a lot of streaming for corporate clients, and one of the things that we deal with is that if I want to do a raw stream that's going to go to the iPad or the iPhone, and I don't want to run through Wowza server or something like that, I have to have some serious hardware, that's not cheap. You know, where if I want to do a Flash stream, I can use Wirecast, or Flash Media Encoder. Or if I want to, there's a lot of easy ways to do it from a laptop or a desktop. If I want to do some of these wider formats, and it's much more complicated to do it, directly to the iPhone and the iPad, and it just seems like that's something that Apple has been missing. But speaking of streaming, though, Amazon is talking. Here comes a rumor. Amazon, and I'm very excited about this rumor.
it's because it's got Netflix in a title.
Anything that has Netflix in the title. I bike about an hour and a half a day, a stationary bike, it is counteracts my love of food, but I usually do it in front of a big TV with Netflix, some movie one after the other. So I'm very very attached to my Netflix and my Apple TV too, but it looks like Amazon is rumored to have a free unlimited video streaming to its Prime members. How many of you guys are Amazon Prime?
I am. Love it.
I am not.
You're not. You're not. How is that possible? Tim, are you an Amazon Prime?
Nope.
Oh man, it's like that is like crack. That's all I gotta say.
Totally.
It's like once you have Amazon Prime, I buy everything except for perishables. Like I can't imagine Amazon delivering oranges yet. but pretty much everything else. It's like I check Amazon Prime. Is it gonna? Can I get it tomorrow? And then I go order somewhere else. It's totally addicting. But they have, they're talking about making that provided. Now, here's the question for you, Larry. Is this really from the media perspective, is this a you know, these large media companies need competition. Is this a push for them to try to start evening out Netflix widening lead over everybody else?
Well, I think there's nothing I like better than speculating on a rumor, Alex. I think that
yes.
that this rumor of what Amazon is doing, it means it is spectacularly easy to use. It's unbelievably powerful, and it's free. And best of all, the chips a week ago Tuesday. It's how can it not be everything we could possibly imagine? Speculating on a rumor is one of the most fun things to do because nobody can get arrested for it.
Exactly.
But it has very limited value to the thing actually ships because it's in the implementation of how it works. I mean, look at just, what was it? The Samsung tablet said that they had this great sell-in for 2 million units and a sell-through to end users of very, very small. Why? In execution, it didn't work as well as it was supposed to. It wasn't until you got your hands on it. You realized the thing was not ready for prime time.
Right.
So in answer to that, media is struggling to try to find a way to make money in the new internet-driven economy, and nobody has figured out the answer yet. Apple is rumored to be working on subscription service. Amazon is rumored on working on this new streaming. Everybody is trying to figure out a way, how are they going to move the revenue from traditional broadcast and cable into the internet, and nobody's got an answer. And this is the thing that drives everybody nuts, because we can't figure out the solution, because people want it for free.
Tim, is there a time limit to how long this can go on before Netflix has a lead that is almost impossible to pick up on?
I don't think so, because they get their content from the studios, and there's a love-hate relationship going on there. As long as they can keep the studios happy enough to give them the content, I think they're going to keep that lead. But, if you look at DVDs, we didn't buy our DVDs all from one place. You know, you could get them at Walmart, you could get them at Target, you could get them at your local video store, you could buy them at Blockbuster. And I think we're going to see that same thing happen here. Again, boils down to those business models. And, you know, studios are being very careful not to erode the current business models. But if they don't, there will be an Apple that will come along and take the music business away from them.
I mean, here's the other question for you, Lon. Is, you know, Netflix is spending, it looks like they're going to spend over $1 billion a year on movies and, you know, paying back for those things. When does Netflix just start funding content themselves?
I'm surprised they haven't already. I mean, there seems to be, if they have that much money to spend, they could certainly do some pretty decent television. In fact, they could probably do some of the niche shows that I like to watch that never get renewed. might find a home there. So I'm sick of getting into a show and only seeing it get canceled. It's really been disheartening. But I mean, with that kind of money, you know, you look at some of the stuff that A&E is doing, right, with like Mad Men and The Living Dead and all those great shows that they've got. Can you imagine if they put even... You know, that can't be $1 billion budget for all those shows, right? I mean, they could do a lot with that money.
It seems that, to me, it seems like that there's this invisible wall that I think that a lot of these companies that are trying to distribute media are getting closer and closer to, where they're getting more and more impatient with dealing with Hollywood. And if they get too impatient, they may start funding a lot of their own content and just saying, well, then we own it. You know, we don't need to go through all this trouble.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say that it's kind of like HBO, which used to subscribe to HBO to watch movies. And once the VCR really came into its own, that began to dwindle a bit. And they really came back by offering really high end content that only was on HBO and still remains that way. Showtime has done the same thing as have other networks too. So I wonder if we're just going into a new version of paid premium television where that content's going to be the differentiator.
But the concern that I've got is that there's a world of difference between distribution and production. And we've seen a lot of efforts at people coming in saying, I've got distribution, but I want to create a film, and the film is, or define film however you want, program. And the program has been a flop. Netflix is not leaning to any of its internal business strengths by switching itself over into production. And it took HBO almost 7 years to make the transition from being a cable outlet that played other people's movies into making its own movie. It's not the sort of switch you can flick easily. And if it was, more people would be making successful films. It's just production is hard, and it takes time, and it takes expertise that's not part of the standard distribution model.
Well, I agree with you. I think that the issue, though, is that, you know, I think the number I saw was the money spent on films, producing films in the United States was somewhere in the vicinity of, I want to say, somewhere between $5 and $10 billion, which is, you know, the you know, Apple's, you know, profit from last quarter. You know, I mean, like, you know, these big companies, if they decided that they wanted to dive into this, they could do an awful lot of damage, you know, pretty quickly as far as actually producing. And, you know, this is, you know, these cable companies, I mean, that's a lot of what, when you look at Magnolia Pictures, for instance, now you have a vertical market, you have a company that owns, you know, they own Landmark, they own HDNet, they own, you know, this is Mark Cuban, you know, going, we're not only going to try to get other people's stuff, we're going to make our own movies. And, you know, I think that, you know, building that kind of, you know, vertical market may be something that may have to happen at some point for these technology companies to just start to at least, I don't think they need to take it over, but I think that there's an opportunity to start to use that to apply more pressure to a lot of these companies. You know, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to own the market. You only have to have 5 or 10% of it that you can whip around like an axe.
There's a lot of out of work production people that would love to have people start spending money right now. So I hope you're correct.
Yeah.
It only benefits the industry to have more production going on and more stories being told.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll see how it goes. Now, speaking of someone who's going a different direction for media, and this is going to be our final story of today, is Pepsi is again going to reinvigorate their refresh project. So last year, for the first time, they took the money that they were going to spend on the Super Bowl. And for the first time in 23 years, they took more than $20 million in grants, or more than $20 million and gave it as grants, ranging from $5,000 to $250,000. And it was distributed to 400 winners last year. And this includes things like, and this is according to New York Times, this includes things like $25,000 for new uniforms for Cedar Park High School, you know, $250,000 for research. And what people do is, they, you know, they put up what they want to do with $250,000 or $5,000 or $25,000, and people vote on it, and the winners are actually, you know, getting this funding. Pepsi has declared this a big success. You know, what's happening is you have a lot of companies who are you know, looking at you know, a lot of companies using their social networks, using their other networks to promote their ideas, bringing people all back into Pepsi, and it also is connecting Pepsi with, of course, you know, a lot of good causes. Lon, do you think that this is a real viable future for marketing for large companies? Should other companies follow Pepsi's lead?
I think anything companies do to do that sort of thing is a good thing, and it is a great way to get some attention on things. And, you know, for a brand like Pepsi that's as big as it is, some would argue, you know, do they even need that Super Bowl exposure when there's so many other options year to year, that they can take some of that money, write it off for a good cause, and help people along the way. It's not such a bad thing.
Tim, how far could this go to replacing traditional advertising?
You know, it really depends on the needle and can it move the needle. I mean, that's always been the problem with web video, is that we can aggregate audiences and we can get a lot of views over a period of time, but it's really hard for us in web video on a Thursday to get people to watch something and then want to go see the movie on Friday or Saturday. TV can still do that. We haven't been able to do that yet. And so I think until social media can actually move the needle for companies, I mean, I don't know that Pepsi really increased their bottom line. I think they're using this to get ahead of a problem that they see happening in the future, and that may be a backlash that's similar to the tobacco problems that the cigarette companies had, whereas the product that they have is a product that people love and people drink it all the time. But how healthy is that product for you? You know, that's up for debate. And will there be a backlash to that? And are they trying to do good now to soften the blow when that happens later?
Larry, how do you think, does this have a lasting effect on their brand, or they just have to keep on doing it to keep that brand building towards that positive connection?
Well, first, I really want to agree with what Tim is saying. I think that there's no doubt social media can influence opinions, but the jury is still out on whether that social media can generate sales. I think Tim is dead on with that.
Well, I don't, you know, but a lot of branding is not about generating sales directly. You know, it's not about getting people out there to buy it. It's about creating a warm fuzzy about that brand, which...
Well, yeah, and I think anything that creates a warm fuzzy about a brand is a good thing, and this is another of the good things. There's a note here that Pepsi was saying in the same article that they were not taking philanthropy dollars. They were taking dollars that were allocated for advertising and using this as an advertising vehicle, as a brand awareness vehicle, and not just simply giving money to good causes. So that they very much wanted to use this to create warm and fuzzy feelings for the brand. And I think it does a very good job of that. I think also Tim asks the really good question of the reason that you advertise is not because you simply want to be perceived as a good company. You want to be perceived as a good company whose products deserve to be purchased, and let's buy the products. And I think on the second point, the jury is out. On warm fuzzy, what Pepsi's doing is building a Pepsi community. And they're building a Pepsi community. First, they do it through advertising. They do it through the Pepsi generation. Then they do it through social media. It's I belong to Pepsi, or Pepsi belongs to me, however you want to phrase that. And that's what good, smart companies have been trying to do for a long time. Apple is master at this, where you are in the Apple fan club and you're part of the Apple family.
And that's worked out okay for them. I mean, you know, I have to admit, like, I probably don't eat or drink very many Pepsi products at all.
No, but you're a Netflix fan.
I am.
Netflix has done a great job of getting you to feel part of their community.
Yeah, by having a great service. You know, it's one of those things I don't, you know, that's particularly the piece of that puzzle of good implementation. But it does, you know, I have to admit that if Pepsi put out more healthy products that I'd be more likely to eat, I'd be much more likely to purchase them, because I feel like I'm supporting a company that is positively affecting the world. And I would love to see companies use this. I mean, I love the idea that companies are not just looking at it as philanthropy. I mean, I always want to see a good business model for making a difference. And so I think that companies looking at this as we're going to get good exposure, it means that there'll be more dollars than just that we're going to give something away, you know. And so so I'm excited to see this going on. I'm actually scheming I'm scheming on producing my own little proposal for Pepsi Refresh this year.
Cool.
I think this week in media bomber jackets is something that the world does not need.
Yeah, I would like some swag.
I have a whole proposal that we're finishing for some of the stuff we're doing in Africa, and we were just like, you know, we had to put that out in the Pepsi Refresh, and we were just thinking about it, and then we're like, oh, it ended. And then, of course, this came out, and we were like, okay, it started up again. We can do it. So so people have to stay tuned and see if we actually put one up there. So, Larry, where can people find you?
You can find me at www.larryjordan.biz. That's JORDAN.BIZ.
Tim, where can people find you?
One Tim Street on Twitter.
And Alon, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter, LONSEIDMAN. And if you want to check out my BBS that I set up in over the winter here, it's bit.ly/LonBBS. And check it out. You'll log in all the Telnet and see Art Glory. It's great stuff.
So. This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out. This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn, with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.